All right. Good afternoon. My name is Alora Agston. It is May 30th, 2026 in Hudson, New York. I'm here with Michael Shanides. We are at the Spark of Hudson, and we're doing Michael's oral history as part of the Community Library of Voice and Sound and Oral History Summer School. I am a student of Oral History Summer School. Michael, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, so Michael Shanides. Really happy to be part of this interview collection. It's been like such a feature of who Hudson is like knowing all these different people who've been involved with the Oral History Summer School or like creating this archive. And then there's been all these cool public events where you get to listen back to it. So it's like really nice to be part of this process.
Amazing. Thank you. All right. So my first question for you, could you tell me about something that shaped you from an early age?
Well, I thought about sharing the first time I went to city council here in Hudson, which, you know, I spent eight years in county government. And so before I was an elected official, one of the first times I went to city council, I thought I would sort of tell that story. So I was in my early 20s, and there was like this pickup soccer game that happened at the Waterfront Park. At the time, the Waterfront Park was somewhat new as a public feature. Historically, it had been a storage ground for like fuel, and it had sort of been recovered from its industrial age and turned into a public park. And there was this like pickup game that I would go down and play at the waterfront. Like, it's really a beautiful scene. It was mostly Bengalis who lived in Hudson, but they were like mostly teenagers. But there were really like people from age 7 to probably in their 60s, maybe like people from like 10 or 12 different countries. But the core was these Bengali teenagers, and I was a little bit older, in my 20s. We'd go down and just play pickup soccer. They were after school. It was, for me, it was after work. It was just really like fun experience getting to meet. Like, I made a lot of my core friends like from that experience. And, you know, we'd be playing. Afterwards, the sun would be setting. There was sort of like a lot of like the kids' families would be like walking around who weren't playing, and it was just sort of this like idyllic time. People would come and watch sort of after the game, and then everyone would go and socialize. And it was such a like magical time for me of like the like possibility of what Hudson was. And it kind of came crashing down when the city tried to ban soccer from this park. I think it was happening, like there were days that I wasn't playing, and I would just sort of hear these reports from the younger kids being like, oh, the cops came and told us that we weren't allowed to play. And so I started to go more frequently because it's sort of the request was if I was there, I might be able to help navigate what was going on, being one of the few adults who played and also one of the few people who spoke English as like my first language, that I would just sort of be in a better position to understand what's going on. And so there was a time that I came and a police officer came and was sort of apologetic. He was like, hey, this is really cool that you guys are playing soccer. I'm actually a soccer player myself, but that there was mayor's orders to kick the kids away. And so I was pretty upset, and it just felt like this is such a perfect experience for me, but it's also like really ideally what you want people to be doing in your community is like go get some exercise, get together and hang out, and like what better use of a park than to do that. And so me and a bunch of the soccer players, there's probably like 12 of us, or like I was probably the one adult, like went to City Hall to try to figure out what was going on. And I think I kind of imagined this as like, oh, this is going to be kind of wild. Like, we're just going to show up at City Hall. But also thought that we would probably get the runaround. Like, we would get like a secretary or an aide who would sort of be like, let me schedule an appointment and sort of push us away. And I think it was kind of fascinating how small Hudson is, that we just like knocked on the mayor's door and there's just like, there it is. Like, we're actually just talking, like the 12 of us just like pile into the mayor's office and talk to the mayor about it. And so it was like this interesting aspect of like, on the one hand, we're being punished for something like we really shouldn't be, but also we just have this access to the power makers and we could just go have this conversation. The mayor basically pushed it off and said that it was really the common council, which is like our, like the equivalent of our city council or legislature. He was really saying that go talk to them. And so we went and talked to the legislature, and there was a clear split in the legislature where like there were definitely people on the legislature who did not want us to play soccer. We had these like really wild arguments that I thought did not make any sense around why we shouldn't play. And then ultimately we won that battle. I think like we got a lot of good press coverage And it was really just like we made our case to the city council, and we were basically able to get enough votes to like split the council, and then ultimately like, we returned to playing soccer. And so it felt like this really victorious moment of like David and Goliath, of like the kids like went against the power elite and sort of won and sort of like returned our right to play soccer. And so it was a sort of a moment for me around like engaging in local politics. It was my first experience, and it felt both like we could do it, like with a group of like a small group of people can actually go in and make a change, and the risk of not taking that action is pretty high because these really kind of horrific things can happen to people. And then it also made me, I think I had this exalted feeling of like people who are in local government must be these like super savvy like people, and I think there's sort of intimidation and just being like, oh, these are just like regular people, and some of them have good ideas and some of them have bad ideas, and that it, I guess it was a sort of flattening of being like, there is a power elite who have power, and but there's like nothing special about it. They just have power, and so there's like a way for us to exercise to make the city that we want to live in.
Thank you so much. That's a wonderful story to hear. So in that story, I hear lots of kind of themes of like advocacy and community engagement. What does community engagement mean for you in Hudson?
I think there's this, I mean, the maybe like the why it was so formative to me is there's this feeling of like, of there are people who make decisions, and then there are like lots of people who are impacted by those decisions, and then there's a sense of like who has the right to like have their decisions on equal value. And so even like part of the debate around that soccer issue was the people who wanted to ban soccer kept on referring to that there were complaints, like that was their language, and the complaints were There was no person who was like, I am the complainer. Like, no complainers were ever mentioned. And even, like, the specificity of the complaints were never mentioned. And so you sort of had these, like, invisible complaints that were given more weight than, like, a group of actual people who were there ever, like, people who were using the park every day and wanted to be able to play soccer were sort of discounted and considered less important than these sort of invisible complainers that it wasn't even clear if the complainers were even real, if that was just like a fictitious argument. But there was, and I think in a very literal way, it was like who was allowed to use the park, right? Like you have a public space and are certain people basically not allowed to use the park, and that whether that was intentional or unintentional, like that was the very real effect, that there was a group of people that were being told like you're not as equal as some other people. Like invisible complainers are more powerful than other people. And so for me, community engagement is about like leveling that playing field and making sure that people who are impacted by decisions have like an equal say in how the decisions are going to impact them. And ultimately, everybody in the city should feel like they have a stake in the public space, and that they also get to help drive the decisions that are going to impact them. And so community engagement, I think, is a way to like rebalance those scales.
Thank you. Just a follow-up question. When did, like, do you remember like what year roughly, like when all of this started or like when this took place?
It's probably like 2005.
2005. Okay. Cool. So since then, how have you kind of continued your pattern of community engagement?
Yeah. I mean, I think some of that experience for me was also just like, this is how you make friendships. And mm-hmm. like, you know, I had made friendships on the field, but it like, to some extent, like that struggle, that like common, like it leveled up our relationships. And so there's, I'm not sure, in some ways it's like not about community engagement. It's maybe more about community for me. It's like a lot of like, you know, even in the last few days, like a lot of people that I met during that process have like reached out and been like, hey, let's get together 20, you know, and I don't know if that would have happened if we hadn't sort of like had that more political struggle. Like there was a certain bonding to that experience. And I think for a lot of them, it was also like for their teenage years, it was also sort of a way of taking power when they're often sort of like pushed out. And so I think there's a little bit of like I want to show up for my friends and show up for people that I care about. And so there's like, it's like being open to when someone asks for something, like you try to figure out how you can solve problems together. And that is like a, it's a fun thing for me to do, and it's a way that people get closer. And so I think a lot of, like, a lot of the things that, I guess that's the approach I just take to life, is to be like, when you see people needing something, like, you try to figure out how to solve things, and also vice versa, of, like, asking people to get involved or to help when you need something. So I think I certainly have had, you know, that was 20 years ago, and I have 20 years of sort of stepping up or like, supporting people to work on things.
Thank you. Can you tell me some more experiences that you've had of trying to work within the Hudson community to support people on these issues?
Yeah. So I, you know, like I mentioned, I served on county government for eight years. And I think some major formative experiences in between this sort of moment in 2005 and when I ran for office was I really got involved with a lot of immigration work. I guess it was probably around like 2015, 2016, because it was like right around like when Trump was first getting elected. And I think it also partly came out of this same vein of like people asking for help. So I had become more involved, and I had become chair of the Democratic Party here in Hudson. And I had some Latino friends who were like, we're really excited to have you as chair of the Democrats. Like, we want to like help get the Latino community more involved with the work that you're doing. And so I had like a meeting with a few people, and in some ways the meeting was somewhat framed around how can they help me, and I kind of turned around and I was like, well, what do you need? And I talked to a couple of people who didn't live in Hudson. They like worked on some farms like nearby, and they were like, the number one challenge to our life is that we are not allowed to have driver's licenses. Historically, what had happened was that anybody could get a driver's license through like the normal means of like you take the test, you get your insurance, like you turn in your paperwork and get a driver's license. You didn't have to be a citizen. After 9/11, like that changed in New York State, and they basically rescinded the ability. It made it much harder for non-citizens to get driver's licenses. And so, you know, these people were reflecting. They're like, look, we work on a farm. We're kind of remote. Like, we're here, we're here around, we're working hard, and, like, for us to go to the grocery store, we either have to walk miles, or we, like, are potentially put, you know, like, we have to risk doing something illegal to, like, get a car and drive, and it's a big burden, and there's lots of places where, you know, immigrants get licenses, and we used to be able to do that in New York. We want to change that. And so I was excited to sort of get involved with that, and it made sense. I was like, we're all going to be better off if people can, like, get insurance and take the test and get a license. I had, like, a close friend who was actually working on this issue at the statewide level to make a change. And so we talked about it, and we were like, it would be really nice to get the Hudson Common Council. This is like the same body that I went to get the right to play soccer, is to make like a symbolic act of passing resolution in support of driver's licenses. And at the time it was considered somewhat controversial, because I think that the sense was that the Democrats in Hudson sort of like shouldn't take these kind of like political or progressive stances, and that like it wouldn't pass, but it was like misbranded. And I think like some of the same national arguments we have now around like centrism versus like progressivism were maybe taking place, or just felt like this was coded as the wrong thing to do. And from my sense, it wasn't necessarily out of a particularly, like, it wasn't about that debate around progressivism and centrism. It was more like, look, this is, like, people want access to driver's licenses. Like, that's not really, like, doesn't have to be a partisan or ideological issue. It's just, like, our community is better off, and we're better off by standing up for that. And so, so we, like, put together a coalition to advocate for this, and we actually had some, like, really powerful testimony from local people talking about how important this was for them. And there was a woman who had like moved here because of domestic violence, sort of like separated from her partner. And she had like a young child, and she was like, look, I'm just like, if I had a driver's license, like I could like take care of my child so much easier rather than having to like walk my child like miles to school. If I had a driver's license, I could just drive him. And so like, why wouldn't we do that for this woman? And lots of like powerful speakers sort of giving testimony. And what started as like a, when we first brought it up, many of the council members were really hostile and actually like quite personally rude to me in ways that were like not, you know, like it's a community place, like people know each other. And I feel like they used the fact that they knew me as a way to be like extra mean. And it's just like a feature of sometimes the way things in Hudson can work is that people can be sort of unneighborly even when people are trying to do their best to make things happen. But ultimately, like, we persevered, we, like, overflowed the council chambers in advocacy for this. And what started as, like, a fairly hostile council, it was actually a quite a nice moment that it actually passed unanimously. So over the course of a few months of sort of making the case, we actually did convince a lot of people to change their minds, and it passed, and it sort of, Hudson was actually the first in this sort of, like, multi-year campaign. The city of Hudson was the first place to pass a resolution like this. Many places ultimately ended up doing it, but it was, like, kind of a big shock, I think, that people didn't expect a place like Hudson to do that. I think the typical way that it would be, like, New York City or one of the more major cities, rather than, like, a small city in upstate to pass that. And so it was sort of, like, a boost to the campaign. It was, like, the sort of first model legislation. And for us, it was also like a time of a lot of friend making and a lot of like connections and building out this place of like, we can actually stand up and do bold things for each other. That coalition really became a lot of the bones for, it was probably a year later, we then passed a resolution through the city to basically do like a non-cooperation agreement with ICE. Is that so? That was probably in 2016 or 2017. That like with the election of Trump and sort of like Trump's like very overt messaging that he was going to target immigrants, is that we really didn't want to waste our local resources on that kind of abuse. And so that was sort of a stepping stone of being like, look, we have to step up for our community, make sure that people feel safe. You know, like they can drive now, but we also don't want the people to get picked up and all the painful things that we're seeing now. Because of like the way ICE is abusing people, you know, we were kind of starting to see that forecasted back then, and so wanted to take some real clear steps to make people feel safe. There were sort of reasons to be like, we don't want to waste our local resources, but we also want people to be able to trust local authorities, and so it was so important that we kind of made this separation, that we can't stop ICE what it's doing, or the local government can't on its own, but at least we're not going to contribute to that. And that also started as a very... It was sort of seen as like I think many people thought we wouldn't succeed, and that there were people on the council who were, again, quite rude and quite I think rude to me personally, but like rude to the whole community and how they behaved. But ultimately, over the course of several months, I think like people came around, and that resolution also passed unanimously, you know, with a bipartisan support. Because I think people saw that ultimately when it comes down to it, you have to step up for community. So there is like an aspect of community engagement there that it's about giving people an equal playing field, but also creating a sense of empathy that we're all in this together and we have to step up for each other. And so from there, I think like from those two campaigns, I was very much branded as an immigration activist. And so I think people were both celebratory of that. And then when I decided to ultimately run for office, I thought I could do more. And there was, I think some people were really excited about that, but I also got this like a weird thing of like, even people who had been supportive of me and people who identified as progressive would say like weird things to me, like, oh, I'm too focused on immigrants, which I thought was like a funny thing to say. But I think like ultimately that was like part of my path into local government was like, I know how to get stuff done, but ultimately the way you get stuff done is by working with a lot of people to foreground what the right solutions are.
I have so many ideas for question now, but this is very fascinating. Thank you. I guess just a follow-up question for the historical record.
Yeah.
The non-cooperation with ICE agreement that you got in like 2016, that time, is that still in effect now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. Excellent. Good to know. And then I guess my first thought, since you kind of ended on that note of community, what are some strategies, ideas, techniques, whatever you would like to discuss? How do you build coalition in a place like Hudson?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my experience of Hudson, you know, I guess I just told the story where I was sort of like the central actor or agent, and I kind of like vaguely referred to community, but I think that there have always been lots of other people who are also like have their like who are also really active. And so that was oftentimes really crucial is that it's a small place like Hudson, a handful of people stepping up who each know a lot of people just brings a lot of things to it. So to some extent, it's like, who are you working with? You know, and like, in this arc around that, those immigration issues, the Columbia County Sanctuary Movement was sort of like formed. I think like a lot of the people who were doing the sanctuary movement were involved with the driver's license issue. And then like it formed sort of like in the midst of that second campaign around the non-cooperation. And so a lot of those, the like key leaders of that movement, they were just people that in the community, and they just sort of formed this organization. But there were so many other people who brought different things to it. And so I think like when I think about like campaigns, I often have like a certain role where I'm probably like the more nerdy or the more like communications angle person, or like the person who like writes the legislation. But there's oftentimes like the people who know 50 people who will bring a lot of people out, or the person who's like willing to say something in a bold, persuasive, charismatic way, or the person who like has never been to a public meeting before and this is gonna be their first time. So to some extent, it's just like it's about like giving people opportunity for leadership and like letting them lead, and then utilizing their skills, I guess I would say. And so I think that, you know, I do have the opportunity where I have a national job now where I like sort of like work with people in cities the size of Hudson all across the country. So I have a little bit of comparison contrast. So some of it is like, you know, I really just know Hudson and I have those experiences. But what I can see is that that's a common thread in most places, that a small number of people can make a difference because they have these large networks of people. And so I guess those would be some of the key ingredients. And then, I mean, the stories that I've told so far are really focused on the Common Council, and that is like, or like for the non-cooperation agreement, there's also a lot of stuff that had to do with the mayor and the executive branch. But to some extent, it's also like there's just people. Like we're talking about like the Common Council is 11 people on the Common Council, and you add in the mayor, it's 12 people. Like ultimately, there's a little bit of like who you're trying to convince, and some of it is you want to have the whole public behind you. You want to have popular support. You want to have people coming out. But then when it comes down to it, it's like, look, you have 11 people that you want to vote on something. And in the beginning, you know, there might be four of them who are really really mean and rude. But like, you know, in the end, like, what is the path to getting a majority? And then you know, even better if you can get like everybody, go for it. So like, I guess those are some of the ingredients.
How do you talk with people who disagree with you?
Well, I mean, honestly, I think the most important thing to do is to talk to somebody who they trust. And so, I mean, I think there's people who disagree with you, but you can have an honest conversation with. And I like, there are many of those people, but I actually think it's more like when you're talking to people who are positions of power and they disagree with you, my sense is that they often don't like, there's no convince, like, I don't think you can like directly convince people of things very often. And that was certainly a big part of my learning curve of like serving in the county government, where that was a more direct part of my experience. But I think some of it, like, you know, in these battles in the council, is that there were people who didn't agree with me, and there was no like, it wasn't like I'm going to like sit down with them and like have a conversation and convince them otherwise. So I think to some extent it's like, well, look, how can you be neighborly? How can you understand what their concerns are? Like we may as well just get along if we don't agree with each other. Like, what does that conversation look like? And so, you know, the skills around listening or moving things along. But I actually think the biggest piece of persuasion is that people are really social. And so there might be people who, they're not going to agree with me no matter what I say, but they will, like, they'll take counsel from somebody else. And so it's kind of about who is that person going to take counsel with that I might have a better conversation with. So in terms of like strategy of making things happen, that's like, it would be like, look, how do I like foster this relationship where someone doesn't agree with me, so I don't make it any worse. But ultimately, if I want to persuade them, it's like really about persuading their friends. And so I think that's a big part of like how things work. And certainly in those examples where people are mean to me and then ultimately voting for the thing I'm putting forward, it was because somebody in between me and them like ultimately convinced them. And so like that's like the strategy, I guess, of like building coalition is like getting more and more people who have their own relationships to get other people involved.
So you've mentioned a few times just kind of roles you've had in local government. What roles specifically? You mentioned a county office. What other roles have you had?
Yeah, so I served as a county supervisor, which is sort of the equivalent of being a legislator, for 8 years, for four terms. I served as mayor's aide for just under one term, so like a year and a half. And I guess that's mostly it. I also was like a technician for the Board of Elections for a few years. That was just like a part-time gig right around election time, as I like went and like made sure the machines worked, which was a pretty fun job back in the day. The machines were mechanical, and so they were just sort of these like fascinating machines where every time someone votes, they like tick like a lever, and then the lever would sort of like calculate votes in this like giant machine, and then there was a way of like resetting it and setting the machines. And so it's kind of like a fascinating piece of like mechanical technology that at the time undergirded like all of the county elections, but really around the country was kind of the model back then, was that you had these kind of fascinating like industrial age machines that like tracked all the voting. And so basically like right before you unrolled the election machines, you would have these inspectors go out and just confirm that the machines were like were in working order and then were properly sealed, so they weren't going to be tampered with. So I guess that's sort of like an official job.
Follow-up question. Does Hudson, Columbia County, do you guys still have those machines, or are we computerized now?
Yeah, so I worked there as part of the transition when we first got electronic voting machines. And so I assume that like those like there's probably a machine or two for like posterity, but I don't know like where those physical machines are. But now there's all these, yeah, now it's all electronic voting machines. So there's like, yeah, there's a whole like technology stack that's like behind it that is like needs to be coordinated with these like national agencies. There's sort of like a handful of like companies that you go through, and there is still like a corresponding like paper trail and of how all these things work. And so I had like the privilege of sort of seeing that side as right as the electronic voting machines were sort of being rolled out, and I like went to a state training to learn about it. And then when I served in the county government, I like was like one of the committees like that oversaw the Board of Elections. So like I have like a probably like more detailed sense of the mechanics of elections that is quite fascinating. But yeah, but now the electronic voting machines are of like a different system. And it's also fascinating how fast, though, because of some of the technology changes where they do all the early voting counts and absentees are actually sort of like pre-sorted, and then the machine is sort of like counting the votes as the election goes on. So like they can now announce the like initial results like super fast, like, you know, within a couple hours they're like here are all the votes, including the absentees, including the early votes. And there's still like paper ballots that can be confirmed, but it's like fascinating how fast everything happens now because of electronic voting.
One more question on voting, because I also find this really, really fascinating. I know in the 2020s or so, there's been a lot of like national controversy over electronic voting and whether or not it changes results, etc. Lots of conspiracy theories. Did any of that show up in Hudson?
We haven't had a lot of that controversy. I mean, one of the features that we have that not every place has is that there is a paper ballot. So like you have a piece of paper, you mark it with like a pen, and then you feed the ballot into the machine, which then counts it. So you could always go back and look at the paper ballots and compare the results between the machine and the paper ballots. And so I think that places that don't have a paper trail, I do think, is really sketchy, because there's just no way to audit what happened. And so you know, any election you could just count all the ballots. And so there's generally like a standard policy where if it's within a certain range, you'll do a full hand recount. And then I think they also they just do like a spot check of some percentage to confirm that it's not wildly off. And for a long time, the Board of Elections did do a full hand count after every election, even though we had electronic results. And ultimately, it was found that it was fairly costly, because it basically meant that you would like hired a room full of people and spent days doing all the counting. And so they no longer do that. But like, it's sort of at any point somebody could do that. So it has been like a big topic of concern, is like, how much should you do a paper audit of an election that just happened? And so that has been a debate over the years, and there's been different ideas about how serious the paper audit should go on. But I don't think there's really never been a controversy that the election results were not accurate, because you could just do the paper count. And so I think that kind of like mistrust, I think, has not happened. And I think ultimately there has generally been a high amount of trust in our local elections in our local officials to run elections accurately. I think like the Board of Elections have had some tension or matters of concern, but it was never so existential as like, is somebody like stealing an election or somebody falsifying results? It was more like about efficiency, or like the Board of Elections has like two, is like half is Democrat and half is Republican, and there's sometimes some concern that like one side is like not pulling their weight. So it's more like issues of like standard office drama, as opposed to something like existential threatening the elections. And sometimes there have actually been controversies around, I mentioned how fast election results are, and sometimes like I think people have become so accustomed to fast results that I think there were times when election results like weren't released for a day or two, and that caused a lot of concern. And there was maybe some challenges around like they probably should have communicated better about that, but it wasn't that long ago that like people wouldn't, like you might not know for days anyway. And so it's not the same kind of like national controversies that we're seeing that I think are, for the most part, most of those national controversies I think were like specifically drummed up for misinformation reasons rather than like out of like, so again, I think people haven't done that locally, and that hasn't been a mistrust. There has been a fair amount of threats to the Board of Elections from what is believed to be like non-local actors, but basically in the last presidential election, Board of Elections across New York State were getting threats over the phone, over email, like through the mail. So they're like the national context of sort of being against fair and free elections has certainly impacted our local Board of Elections, where it just adds a higher level of stress, where the staff at the Board of Elections have to think about, and when I was in county government, we had to think about the what if, like the idea that there could be like either an actual attack or just a threat. Like, what do you do on a Board of Elections if there's a threat? And so like that happened all the time. Like there was kind of like constant conversation between Homeland Security and state Homeland Security. So like those kind of sort of outside forces have raised the stakes for how elections function in Hudson, that we also tried to keep. We didn't want to, like, I think, like, the average person in Columbia County has not experienced that, and in part, we didn't want to advertise the threats because we didn't want to, like, raise the temperature around voting, and we want people to feel that voting is just an everyday thing that's, like, safe and secure, and that, like, the drama that's happening nationally, I think many people do feel insulated from that when they're participating in elections locally.
Thank you. So we have about 20 minutes left of our interview. I have so many more questions for you. There's lots and lots of things I'd like to ask you about, but I do want to give you the opportunity. Is there anything you really want to talk about that we haven't discussed yet?
No, I'm happy for your next question.
Okay, excellent. Okay, so you've been local office, active in local advocacy. Are you from Hudson originally, if I may ask?
No, I grew up in Georgia.
Okay.
I was in the Hudson Valley, like a little south of Hudson, and so I like was, I think I like moved here in probably right around that like soccer experience, like 2005. But when I moved to Hudson,
like, I had been living in Elizaville, which is, like, 20 minutes south of here in, like, mm-hmm. the southern part of the county, and I was working in Hudson. So I moved to the Hudson Valley in 97, and then started working in Hudson probably 2002, and then moved to Hudson 2005.
Okay. So I guess then my question for you is, roughly 30 years of being in this area, what have you noticed as some of the biggest changes?
I mean, it's changed a lot. I'm sure mentioning, like, every interview talks about how much it's changed. And so I think, like, I mean, I think about I certainly have some combination of, like, nostalgia when I think about, the olden days of Hudson, and maybe just, like, a little bit of mourning of, like, what has happened. And I think that, like, I've just seen, like, I've had, like, so many friends and neighbors who were kind of left Hudson under circumstances that they didn't want, in part just because of the, like, the increasing costs of housing, maybe paired with, like, the difficult job market, has caused a lot of pain. And it's, like, hard to, like, you know, so many of my friends left because of costs, and it, oftentimes, like, at inopportune times. You know, I had a friend who, she was 8 months pregnant, and her, like, banister broke, and she reported it to her landlord, and the landlord, like, rather than, like, fixing it up to code, just, like, evicted her. Or, like, somebody who had, who was, like, about to go into, I think they had just gone into surgery, they're in a wheelchair, and then their landlord, like, didn't want to renew their lease and turn the place into an Airbnb, and they had to, like, find a new place, like, while they're disabled, and sort of, like, meeting, you know, like, somebody who had, like, sort of meeting all these people who are either struggling in this one moment, it's a very inopportune time, or, like, leaders and pillars in the community who just couldn't find a new home and had to go. And so that, I think, has, it's been hard for me, because it meant that I lost a lot of people, and the sort of normalcy of, like, day-to-day or week-to-week life just changes a lot when you lose your friends, and I make it sound like they're still alive, but, like, they're not in Hudson, so, like, you're just not part of your day-to-day life. And I think it's also contributed where Hudson is just sort of a little less rooted. When I first moved here, it was, like, I was a new person, but there were so many people who knew each other for such a long time, and I think now in Hudson, there's so many people who just moved here a few years ago, and so I think that certainly has, like, transformed it. That's gonna be funny to say. Like, I have met, like, a lot of my best friends are people who just moved here, but I still sort of, like, miss the fact of sort of some of that, like, stability that the neighborhood used to have.
Thank you for sharing that, as well as, like, your personal experience with your friends and how their lives have been affected by this. Before we run out of time, I really want to ask about the shuttle.
Yeah.
Tell me about the shuttle.
Yeah, that is, like, as much as, like, I ran for office, I feel like I was, like, known as, like, an immigration rights advocate, and I think when I left county office, like, I was, like, known as the public transportation person. And it actually started... The advice that I got from somebody was, look, I'm going to be serving in the minority. I'm going to be one of the youngest people in office at the county level. And I do have kind of this brand that might not jive with the, like, more conservative part of the county. It was, like, just find an easy thing to do and, like, get a victory and build off of that. So I was like, okay, I'll look for something easy. And somebody had asked me about, we have these bus stop signs, like, that people have around buses that, like, give the schedule on a sign. And someone had pointed out that the bus stop signs were not accurate. They actually, like, the city used to manage the shopping shuttle. It gave it over to the county. It had been, like, 10 years, but the signs had never been updated, and the schedule was actually drastically different than was on the sign. And I was like, that seems like an easy thing that I need for me to do. Someone asked me to work on this. Cool, I'll do that. And little did I know, it was actually quite difficult. And I assume that part of that is because there just wasn't that much interest in having a functioning transportation system. And then I was also who I was. And that same way where I was like, people don't... Earlier in the interview, I mentioned how people who don't agree with you, there's just nothing you can say. It felt like that. I was like, I just want to make these bus stop signs accurate. And I was, like, literally having debates about whether or not should you have bus stop signs. Like, that's where it started. People were actually arguing with me that the inaccurate bus stop signs was better for some reason. But, like...
that has often been my experience with people in power, is that they defend what they're going to do. And so I had probably 15, 20 meetings. I was going back and forth because they were on city property, but it was a county service, and everyone was basically just trying to not make it happen. I had like 15, 20 meetings. I was actually, to figure out how to get these bus stop signs updated. And eventually I did it, but it was like, I had to like call a friend who worked for the paper. It's sort of like I hit a dead end, and at some point I had to call a friend who worked at the paper and sort of like plant a story about how the bus stop signs were inaccurate to sort of raise the temperature of what was going on. And eventually, I think it was probably like a 9-month or a year long process, we got like 5 new bus stop signs to make it accurate. But it was like, that was the sort of amount of labor that it took to do something super easy, or what should have been super easy. And so it was a lesson in like how to get things done. And I think I learned a lot in that process. But it also did give me, like, succeeding on that little small thing gave me, it both made me Mr. Transportation. We actually formed a transportation committee at the county level, which I eventually became the chair of. And I was like one of the few Democrats like chairing a committee because of that transportation work. And then once I was the transportation person, because I did those little bus stop signs, that like it got me involved with all this other work that I was like, there's lots of other things for us to fix about the transportation system. And so we actually had to replace a lot of the buses. They didn't have heat in wintertime. I actually figured out that there were like hundreds of thousands of dollars in grants every year we were missing out on because we weren't filling out a piece of paper. And so just like being involved, I found all these opportunities where I actually got a lot more revenue for the transportation system, and then was able to leverage that for new systems. We're here in the Spark of Hudson building, and the Spark of Hudson folks, actually I collaborated with them, and they made like a 3-year grant for us to extend the shopping shuttle hours. So we added 5 hours a day to the shopping shuttle schedule, which goes between Hudson and Greenport. So they no longer are funding that, but based off of that pilot, we are able to sort of launch these extra hours, see how popular it was, and then now the county just covers that in full. And so we also like drastically expanded the service for the shopping shuttle. And then based off of that success, I was able to collaborate with our assembly member and senator at the state level to get some funding to add a route between Hudson and Chatham. And so I made that improvement. So we really drastically improved the revenue. We started getting a lot more outside revenue. We improved the services. We actually didn't have printed schedules. We like made printed schedules and bus stop signs, improved our website, did a whole new like planning system where I brought together a bunch of stakeholders, including like people in government who were saying when I first started that we shouldn't have public transportation at all. Over the course of this process, much like I kind of gave in my previous stories, some of the people who were naysayers in the beginning kind of like turned a corner and became like real champions for public transportation, where it really was like who were suggesting that we have more funding to improve our system. And so a lot of people came around where ultimately it was really celebrated across party lines, and there was a broad support to do more transportation. So by the time we left, we had not only increased revenue a lot, ridership was like at record levels, and there were sort of national trends around public transportation that public transportation is generally going down across the country over the past 10, 20 years. And we actually saw a huge spike post-COVID in ridership, where we had more riders the last couple years that I was on the board than we had ever had for the public transportation service. So that it was something I was very excited about. And I think I can trace some of my success to like the ways that I think about problem solving. But I would also be like, it started with a very specific request. I have this thing. We should have better bus stop signs. And like, it's responding to what people wanted. And even the extension of the hours started with a couple hundred people submitting a petition and us following up and being like, I think we probably should follow that petition. And so, and the Chatham route too, like all of the gains was responding to somebody saying, I need this for my life. And being like, well, how can we do this together? And so it's something I was really excited about, and it's one of the ways I think I learned a lot about myself and how to get stuff done through that process. So I really like it was a real real honor for me. It's like something I'm excited about.
Thank you. What advice would you give for people who are looking to get into local politics?
I might give that same advice that I had reflected someone gave to me, which is like find something that seems easy and get it done. It might not actually be that easy, but I would say that like I would say that, like, think, like, what is the problem that we're trying to solve? And then maybe start with something that's that seems doable, that there's a path to do it, that there is, and then make it popular and try to figure it out. And I think that I have a particular way that I get stuff done that I think is not the only way. And so I think there's probably something about also like finding what people's skill sets are, and then teaming up with people who have a different set of skill sets and making it happen. And that ultimately it's like politics is about the public, and it is about how do people work together to get stuff done. And so I guess that would be my approach. And then try things out, and not everything works. Try it out till it works.
What are your hopes for Hudson and Columbia County broadly for the future?
Yeah. Well, maybe just selfishly, I hope that it's a place where I can continue to have like great relationships with people and have a good time and be a place that I'm proud of, and where I know that my friends and neighbors have the opportunities and the resources so that they can like solve the problems that they need to solve. And that ultimately this is a community where there's like so many like amazing, creative, hardworking people, and they are faced with like really, really difficult challenges. And so it's like, I want to make sure that those roadblocks are removed so people can really truly do what they need to take care of themselves. And I think it has felt like we're at I feel like there's often been this tension as long as I've been here that around class, and that there is sort of like these parallel economies and for that some people can access and some people can't. And ultimately I think that we need to get through that. And so I think there is like a fear that, that working class people sort of won't have a place in here. And I guess also like going back to that, like the story around the park is that like in an ideal world, like everybody has access to that park. It doesn't like matter what class you're from. And if that park is like a metaphor, it would also be like everybody has access to like the job opportunities, and like people aren't shut out of those things. Or everybody has opportunities to start their own business and be an entrepreneur, or to get the healthcare that they need. And so I think ultimately like my hopes and dreams is that we can continue to have that opportunity where people can shape their lives in a way that also allows people to have their like individuality and sort of creativity that is like such a part of our community.
Thank you so much. I think probably that might be,
yeah.
I was just thinking, Tom, like we're right on the border. Is there anything else you'd like to share?
No, I think I'm good.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, Michael Shimides. This has been a wonderful interview. I really have learned so much about the local political landscape of Hudson. I am going to turn off the recorder now and then turn it right back on to do just 1 minute of Room Town, just so
yes.
For the historical record, we know what the room sounds like.
Yes.
All right.